From New York Public Radio, this is On the Media. On the Media is produced by WNYC and heard across America on NPR stations. Visit onthemedia.org to find your local public radio station. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC podcasts are supported by Holy Name Hospital in Teaneck, New Jersey, providing comprehensive centers in cardiovascular services, interventional radiology, and cancer care. More information at www.holyname.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The shakeup of the White House staff has been widely dismissed as minor cosmetics, but one very visible change is the departure of the Bush administration's chief cosmetician. Presidential Press Secretary Scott McClellan resigned on Wednesday, perhaps to spend more time with the truth.
This relationship is built on trust, and you know very well that I have worked hard to earn the trust of the people in this room, and I think I've earned it.
That was McClellan in a press briefing last year, and he's right. He could be trusted by the press corps. He could be trusted to tap dance, change the subject, refuse to answer, and otherwise dodge any question that challenged the administration on presidential leaks, weapons of mass destruction, war casualties, Hurricane Katrina, and other issues of the day. In other words, a politician's spokesman just loyally doing his job. It isn't easy being press secretary for any president because every presidency is afflicted by mistakes, scandals, political calamities, and run-of-the-mill embarrassments. But it was McClellan's miserable lot to be fronting for a boss in a political tailspin, a president at pains to reconcile his own assertions to the American people with ever more well-documented reality. The results in the briefing room, day after day in front of that weary blue drape, were brutal.
As I said, we're not getting into talking about an ongoing investigation. That's what the president indicated as well. And you know, I'm not going to comment further on that.
There are some that are interested in playing the blame game. The president is interested in solving problems.
We have been directed by the White House counsel's office not to discuss this matter. I already get into commenting from this podium while this legal proceeding. For me to even respond to that question would force me to talk about an ongoing investigation.
There is an ongoing investigation,
and you know, I'm not going to comment further on that.
No, he wasn't going to comment on that or that or that. Not because he didn't wish to, but because it's all been covered before, or it would be improper in the midst of a criminal investigation, or because, this was one of McClellan's favorites, the president was more focused on the priorities the American people care most about. Priorities, the White House implies, it is better equipped to decide than some self-appointed media filter. This mentality, and there is no evidence that McClellan felt differently, is not conducive to government transparency. Nor are compulsive secrecy and open contempt for the press conducive to trust in the briefing room. The Bush administration looks at the Fourth Estate and sees a fifth column of enemy subversion. The press room looks at the press secretary and sees a human shield for hogwash. But McClellan's ultimate downfall can probably be blamed on nothing more sinister than timing. His predecessor, Ari Fleischer, was no less chronic a tap dancer and stonewaller, maddening in his own right.
The president has not made any decisions about what military option he might pursue. During the campaign, the president did not express, as you put it, disdain for nation building. Think about the implications of what you're saying. You're saying that the leaders of other nations are viable, and that is not an acceptable proposition.
The press laughed and rolled their eyes, but seldom talked back or raised their voices or demanded the straight answers denied them. This had something to do with Fleischer's command of the room, but probably more to do with the political zeitgeist. In those days, Bush was a popular wartime president and the White House press corps a room full of somnambulant stenographers, plenty maddening themselves. What McClellan faced every day was a very different crowd, embarrassed by their own quiescence and fed up to hear. And as the president's approval ratings indicate, so now is the public, which is why the next presidential spokesperson is in for a tough time. Hiring a new cosmetician does not constitute an extreme makeover, and uttering words is not the same as answering a question. For a chilling journey to briefings past, the new chief, Flack, should check out McClellan's exchange just 1 month ago. The The question was, are staff changes imminent at the White House?
Let me speak very clearly to this. This is part of the inside Washington babble that goes on in this town. It's part of the parlor game. We are focused on the priorities that the American people care most about.
So was that a yes, a no? Impossible to know. But we do know this from now on.
I'm not going to comment further on that.
After a long career as a muckraker and a battle with Parkinson's disease, journalist Jack Anderson died last December at the age of 83. But he'd fought many other battles along the way against such foes as former pal Joseph McCarthy, Richard Nixon, and J. Edgar Hoover. Anderson once told his staff to do an FBI-style investigation on the all-powerful FBI chief. Go through his garbage, he told his staff, and rattle the cans. I want him to know. Now the FBI wants to go through Anderson's stuff. His family has donated a reported 188 boxes of his documents to George Washington University, but the FBI wants to pick through them first. The family has refused. Mark Feldstein, a journalism professor at George Washington University, has been collecting Anderson's papers for a biography. The FBI approached him, too, hoping he would turn them over so that they could be picked through for secrets.
I told them that I didn't have the power to do that. That was up to the university and to the Anderson family. And they surprised me by telling me that Mrs. Anderson, Jack's elderly widow, had signed a consent form to allow them to go through the records. Turns out, according to the family, they sort of sneaked that consent form to Mrs. Anderson after the FBI agent convinced Mrs. Anderson that they were distantly related cousins from West Virginia. And they apparently did it when the younger children were out of the room so that they wouldn't be there to object to the letter being signed.
So do you know whether they have the right to go through those papers or not?
Well, I think the courts are ultimately going to have to decide that. My university and the Anderson family are resisting it. We think it's an unwarranted intrusion into historical materials that have very little relevance and kind of a chilling one for any journalist who tries to protect their sources. And the fact that they're going after him even after he's dead is really unprecedented.
This is, of course, just the latest, though, in a long history of confrontations between Anderson and the FBI, right?
He was notorious for baiting J. Edgar Hoover when the legendary FBI director had most of the rest of the nation's media cowed. There are some who think that this is some kind of FBI revenge. I don't believe that. There's been too much turnover in the FBI since the Hoover days. But there is a sort of fitting irony here that even from the grave, they're taunting Jack Anderson and he's fighting back.
But he wasn't always such a thorn in the side of the U.S. intelligence community. In fact, for a brief time, in his early days as a reporter, wasn't he actually kind of one of them?
Well, he actually was. Back in his early days, just coming out of the military, he for a time was a secret informant for the OSS, the precursor to the CIA. And Anderson was actually very conservative politically in a lot of ways and very patriotic as he saw it. And on numerous occasions declined to publish information if he believed it would truly endanger national security. But the point he made was that most of the time when national security are invoked, they're really about not national security, but political embarrassment. And that's what I can't help but wonder if they're not dealing with here.
Well, then I think maybe we have to jump ahead to the Glomar incident, in which there probably was a very legitimate national security interest, but he bucked the trend of the other journalists, including Seymour Hersh on this story, and went ahead and reported it.
That was a case when the U.S. intelligence agencies were trying to dig up a Soviet submarine that had sunk in the ocean and were using Howard Hughes' help to do so. Anderson reported that story when the rest of the media was holding back. In fact, I've actually gotten access to the transcripts of Anderson and other reporters' conversations with the CIA director. All the other journalists are kowtowing to him and kissing the CIA director's hindquarters, not Jack Anderson. He's keeping him on the phone just long enough to stall him so that they can get the story on the air before any other reporter breaks it.
But did exposing the sunken Soviet sub really serve the American people at that moment?
Well, considering the fact that tens of millions of dollars had been wasted on an unsuccessful effort, he felt the answer was yes. What he didn't know at the time, because the CIA hadn't told him, was that they had reason to believe there were actual nuclear missiles involved and that it could truly be an issue of national security. They didn't trust him enough to tell him that. If they had, he probably would have withheld it.
What were some of his biggest journalistic scoops?
Well, he had a series of journalistic scoops going back to the Truman administration. He was the first to report that the CIA had plotted to assassinate Fidel Castro using the mafia of all unlikely co-conspirators. He was the first to report that the Nixon reelection campaign fund had settled an antitrust action against a powerful corporation in exchange for a donation. He published highly classified documents, more secret than the Pentagon Papers, which showed that the Nixon administration was lying to the public and to Congress about its non-neutrality during a war between India and Pakistan. He first exposed how the chief of staff to Dwight Eisenhower was essentially taking bribes from a businessman. And that episode became notorious when he was caught in the process of reporting the story, caught red-handed eavesdropping with bugging equipment on the industrialist who was bribing Eisenhower's chief of staff.
But the techniques he used to gather those scoops would simply not pass muster today. Actually having financial relationships with his sources, getting involved with congressmen to push pet issues and so on. I mean, as a journalism professor, you can't possibly approve of Anderson's techniques.
There's no question that by today's contemporary standards, a lot of the techniques Jack Anderson used were unsavory. He never tried to pretend to be an objective reporter. He viewed himself as a crusader, and he was in many ways a throwback, the last of the old-fashioned muckrakers.
But by the end of his career, Anderson was written off as an old crank. Few people paid attention to his column. The revelations he printed there were often ignored. What happened?
You know, for several decades, if you had dirt, you came to Jack Anderson. Well, after Watergate, everybody wanted to be an investigative reporter. Sources who had this kind of information could get it in the Washington Post, the New York Times, television, places that had bigger readerships, that had more space for it, that had more prestige and impact. And Anderson lost his monopoly on the dirt.
Mark, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Mark Feldstein directs the journalism program at George Washington University. His biography of Jack Anderson, Poisoning the Press, Richard Nixon, Jack Anderson, and the Rise of the White House Attack Machine, hits bookstores next year.
Coming up, when news lagged behind a radioactive cloud, a look back at Chernobyl and the man who invented Fidel.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. 20 years ago this Wednesday, the world experienced the worst nuclear accident in its history. In the early morning hours of April 26th, an inexperienced technician at the Chernobyl power plant was running an experiment for a safety test, an experiment that triggered an explosion in one of the reactors. Over the next 10 days, radiation, equivalent by some estimates to as much as 100 Hiroshimas, spewed into the atmosphere. The human toll is far less clear. In the immediate aftermath, casualty figures ranged from 2 people, as reported by Soviet media after a 3-day blackout on any information, to 2,000 people, as reported by an American wire service. A UN group has estimated that radiation will ultimately kill some 4,000 people. But this week, a new Greenpeace report concluded it would be more like 93,000. It's a reminder of all that still remains murky about the disaster, including the physical state of the concrete and steel barrier built to seal in the reactor in the days following the accident. In 1987, longtime CBS Moscow correspondent Jonathan Sanders analyzed the initial media coverage in an article called Comrade X Was Wrong. The title referred to a 1940 Clark Gable film about a cynical American reporter in Moscow who went by the alias Comrade X.
Honestly, you make me sick. 2 years ago, I looked up to you as the best reporter in the business, and now look at you.
Face the facts, baby. There ain't no news in Russia.
Ain't no news in Russia. I guess that was the nub of the problem when Chernobyl occurred.
That's right. The Russian news media was an organ of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, so it did what the master said. In 1986, the media was beginning to open up. Gorbachev had done a great deal of talking about glasnost, which means openness or candor, but it was just creaking the door open a crack.
Okay, now this wasn't some sort of Politburo purge or a failed wheat crop. A nuclear catastrophe couldn't be contained within Soviet borders, and I guess neither could the reporting of it. How did the story break, and how were Soviet citizens first informed?
The news came out when a radioactive cloud started drifting over Sweden, and the men in charge of information to foreign journalists in Moscow started saying, it must be a nuclear leak in Sweden. 72 hours, nothing was heard. And then finally, on the evening news, the equivalent of CBS, ABC, and NBC all rolled into one, there was a six-sentence announcement.
На Чернобыльской атомной электростанции произошла авария. Поврежден один из атомных реакторов.
An accident has taken place at the Chernobyl Atomic Energy Station. One of the atomic reactors has been damaged. Measures are being taken to eliminate the consequences of the accident. Help is being given to the victims. A government commission has been established. That was all. But that was a big all because in their media system, people learn to read between the lines. And for smart people, that was a monstrous declaration because they never announced accidents. Accidents happened somewhere else. They happened abroad. Bad things didn't happen at home.
For the Western media, I guess there were two stories going on. One was about the accident itself, and the other about the Soviet reaction to it and how the moral bankruptcy of Soviet communism was revealing itself and so forth. Did that storyline in the Western press ever veer into gloating or jingoism or propaganda of its own?
Jingoism and propaganda in the American media? Bob, that would never happen. Saying we're better than you at the time that Ronald Reagan was calling them an evil empire? How could you say that? Of course it did. Part of it was our fearful reaction against Soviet technology. There was a great gotcha element to the political reporters who were covering Gorbachev. Gorbachev, you're talking about openness and candor, and suddenly there are all these lies coming out. How can we trust you? We're talking about arms control talks, and you're lying to the people about atomic energy. There was a great deal of this moralizing. And to this day, if you talk to Gorbachev about it, he says that enemies in the West exaggerated what was going on and took this out of the harsh anti-Soviet Reagan administration playbook to ridicule and to point a finger at Russia.
And in fact, it was a gotcha moment, I suppose, and one that must have been most revealing indeed for Soviet citizens themselves. Now, what about the practice of journalism? Was there a sea change there? Did journalism cease to become propaganda all the time and actually mutate into something more genuine?
Chernobyl was like that expression, put the pedal to the metal for journalists who wanted change. They wanted to cover the consequences of their own war in Afghanistan, much in the way they saw the better American journalists who covered the war in Vietnam. And Chernobyl is one of the things that many people think of as a significant turning point, not only in the media change in Russia, which has swung like a big pendulum on a big grandfather's clock back and forth and back and forth, and we may be back to where it was when Chernobyl exploded, but to the larger political context in which the Soviet Union collapsed. In those early years after the Soviet Union fell apart, you might say that what was then became Russian journalism was freer, had more possibilities to do different and frank and critical-minded things than any media system, including our own.
Well, it's 20 years later, and there is a democratically elected president in Russia, Putin. And it seems to me that the Russian media, occasionally at least, in the face of national disaster, behaves ever more like Soviet media, with the submarine disaster and the Beslan siege, even where it was unclear for many hours, even days, what was taking place there.
Well, I think on the massest of mass media, Putin has returned to, you know, Gunsmoke, the marshals in town, the marshal keeps order. Television has the same kind of saintly image of the leader. Now it's Putin, then it was Gorbachev, or before him, Chernenko. Accidents don't get reported. But the people in charge of the Russian media system, while they've cracked down tremendously, while they've reharnessed the television industry on a national level, they realize that they don't want to return to the days of people standing handing out underground self-published newspapers on the corners, with the exception of things coming out of the terrorist camps in Chechnya. So far, there has not been the censorship we've seen in China. And in part, this is policy wisdom. They don't want to turn the country into a pressure cooker. They want it to be a tea kettle in which some steam can escape and sound a warning knell. But it's, you know, one of my friends got her teeth kicked in a couple weeks ago because she had been responsible for putting out some very unvarnished, raw information about what was going on in the investigation or non-investigation of the Beslan School massacre. So, you know, bad days are here again is part of the song. And as they get ready for there to be another presidential election in a couple years, I think you're going to see even more crackdowns, even more restrictions, even more of a straitjacket thrown on the Russian media.
Jonathan Sanders served as CBS's Moscow correspondent from 1988 to 1997. He produced the film 3 Days in September about the Beslan school siege. It will premiere at the Tribeca Film Festival on May Day. Jonathan, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Bob. I wish it was a better story.
It's February 1957. Would-be Cuban revolutionary Fidel Castro is assumed by his government and many news outlets to be dead. But then, Ruby Phillips, longtime Cuba correspondent for the New York Times, is approached by some men who say that Castro is in fact hiding in the jungle and wants to meet with an American journalist. Phillips did not jump at the chance. Cuba had become her home, and she knew she'd be deported. Plus, her long tenure had earned her good access to the increasingly repressive regime of Fulgencio Batista. It didn't seem worth the risk, since Castro wasn't likely to win. But finally, she cabled the Times, urging Herbert L. Matthews, former war reporter turned aging editorial writer, to come to Cuba right away. He'd been there before and was eager for adventure, so despite the concern of his editors, he went. And that's where the story really begins in the new book by New York Times reporter Anthony De Palma, author of The Man Who Invented Fidel, Castro, Cuba, and Herbert L. Matthews of the New York Times. Matthews was, in a sense, the best and the worst person for the job. He wrote vividly and passionately, but had a dangerous tendency to fall in love with the causes and characters he covered.
So when he was covering the Italian invasion of Ethiopia, Abyssinia then, in the early 1930s, he believed that Mussolini was doing a great thing and admitted that for a while he believed in the fascist cause. He later on retracted that. When he covered the Spanish Civil War, he believed that the side that he was covering, which were the loyalists, were the side of righteousness. And then in 1957, he shows up in Cuba and interviews Fidel.
The trip there was so taxing, and he spent all those many hours in the car and trekking through the jungle talking about the great revolutionary cause with the people who were guiding him and protecting him. Therefore, once he sees Fidel, he's ready to fall in love.
Well, it's 6 o'clock in the morning. He's been up all night. He's muddy and cold and dirty. Dawn is just breaking in the Sierra, and Fidel comes through the foliage like some apparition. And Matthews immediately, even in the article, describes him as physically powerful, talks about the glint in his eye, and almost from that moment falls for him.
So what was the kind of stage management that Castro applied to the scene?
They're basically sitting on a log for 3 hours. Castro has it all prepared, and he lays out an image of himself as a young, democracy-loving defender of the Cuban Constitution. He says that he's got a number of men with him, armed with telescopic rifles. They've had a number of major battles. They've got Batista on the run. The truth is, he had 18 men at most. He had one telescopic rifle. He has his brother, Raul, who's second in command, send over someone and say, "Comandante, we're getting a report from the second column." Of course, with 18 men, there was no second column. But in defense of Matthews, he had checked with the U.S. Embassy in Havana. They told him hundreds of men. We had run a story the week before citing a figure from the rebel representative in New York saying they had hundreds of men. And our resident correspondent, Ruby Phillips, who had lived in Cuba for 30 years, said, "We believe he's up there and has several hundred men behind him."
Well, let's talk about then what happened. Matthews returns to New York. He writes a 3-part series. It's published in the New York Times. Now, Batista was famously censoring the press at the time. And in fact, those papers, when they arrived, literally had the stories clipped out of them.
Mm-hmm.
But an anti-Batista character was dispatched to New York to buy up the papers, clip those stories out, and send them to thousands of very important people in Cuba. So the stories got around and they were talked about.
Absolutely true. I spoke to that man who's still alive. Mario Llerena is the man's name. He's now in his 90s, but he remembered this story very well. He was a supporter of Fidel's. He was called in by another one of the supporters and said, "We need you to go on a mission." And the mission is to go to New York, get the articles. He handed him the money for the ticket and a copy of the social registry of Havana.
So they went to a great deal of trouble to get this story to the Cuban people. What was the impact?
Just last week, I spoke to someone who was there at the time. He's now an academic in New York, and he said it was electric. Here was the first real news that he was alive. It was coming from a source outside of Cuba, so it was trusted. And it presented this image, which Castro's image in Cuba at that time was a little bit of a roughneck, kind of a loose cannon. He had gone through a couple of other attempts at overthrowing the government that failed utterly. But here he was being presented as a leader, as a romantic figure. Remember, he was only 30 years old. He was young. He had a beard. He had these men up in the mountains.
So he was made a hero, at least initially, by Matthews. But wasn't Matthews made into something of a hero by Castro as well?
Absolutely. They both became heroes at the beginning. Matthews, remember, 57-year-old editorial writer at the newspaper, one day had to go through the doors of the New York Times on 43rd Street in Manhattan and pass by a demonstration, not protesting anything that he wrote, but supporting the articles that he wrote. So it was a demonstration in his favor. Might have bolstered his ego, but it probably made it pretty embarrassing for him to deal with his colleagues in the paper.
And in fact, you write that he was already in a peculiar position of writing both for the news pages and the editorial pages, a position that no reporter is ever allowed to be in. He kept saying, "Trust me, I'm a great asset to your paper." But by dint of writing his opinion in one section of the paper and what was ostensibly objective news in another part of the paper, he couldn't be trusted in either section.
It was a dangerous precedent that was set at that point and never repeated. It was a personal relationship he had with the publisher at the time, and they came up with this super correspondent. The New York Times didn't back away from it. In fact, they used his position as editorial writer and correspondent in advertisements at the time, and they were very proud of what he did. When Castro turned and showed that his revolution was intent on becoming a communist revolution, people looked for someone to blame, and Matthews was the target. And he was blamed by Cubans who didn't like Fidel. He was blamed by our United States Senate in congressional hearings. He was blamed by the journalistic community.
Do you think he deserved that blame?
Someone once said, a professor at Stanford, that blaming Matthews for Castro is like blaming the meteorologist for a storm. I don't think I would blame him for what happened, because I think it would have happened anyway. As a correspondent, he was asked to judge what was the truth at that time. It turned out not to be the truth, but even today, 50 years later, people are writing biographies of Castro, and they still can't say with any real authority whether or not Castro was a communist at the time in 1957 that he did the interview. We still don't know.
You defend Matthews quite a lot in this conversation, but it was a dark chapter in the history of American journalism.
Did he make mistakes? Absolutely. Did he do things that the newspaper, the New York Times, should not have allowed through? Absolutely. Do I, as a correspondent and a longtime staff member of the New York Times, feel proud about everything that he did? Absolutely not. What I was simply trying to do was to look at the story behind the myth, and I found that there was far more myth than there was truth to it.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
New York Times reporter Anthony DePalma is author of The Man Who Invented Fidel, Castro, Cuba, and Herbert L. Matthews of the New York Times.
6 years of surface prosperity and government corruption, of repression and police brutality, bred explosive discontent. Now Batista has fled. A new leader is on the scene. Fidel Castro, in many ways an unknown quantity in his politics and policies, but certain to be dominant in Cuba's new era, just begun.
Up next, political indoctrination for the single-digit demographic and political analysis of the sartorially challenged.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, investing in nonprofits to help them catalyze growth, connect to stakeholders, and challenge greater support. On the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities. On the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Whether by example or by instruction, parents are the most powerful influencers of their children's values and beliefs. But sometimes training is difficult because those adorable little sponges aren't necessarily well equipped for understanding abstract concepts, such as, say, infinity or differential calculus or politics. Many parents forego such abstractions and concentrate on toilet training, scissors carrying, and the golden rule, Others, eager to get the toddlers politically conscious, can turn to a new genre, partisan children's literature. Toss away Green Eggs and Ham, Bedtime with Little Kyle or Courtney can be Jeremy Zilber's Why Mommy is a Democrat, or Catherine Debrecq's Help, Mom, There Are Liberals Under My Bed. But are books like these early civics lessons or early indoctrination? Both authors join me now. Catherine, Jeremy, welcome to On the Media.
Hi, Bob.
Hi.
Catherine, let's begin with you. Describe for me, please, Help, Mom, There Are Liberals Under My Bed, and what you were after in writing it.
Sure. Help, Mom, There Are Liberals Under My Bed is a story about two boys, Tommy and Lou, who ask their parents for a swing set. And their parents say, you know, why don't you earn the money? After all, you'd appreciate it more and become a better person. So they decide to open up a lemonade stand. They are all excited. They go to bed that night and dream of their lemonade stand. And their dream gets stuck in liberal land. And in liberal land, liberals keep appearing from behind their lemon tree, demanding they give half of their money with taxes, make them give broccoli with each glass sold, and make them take down a picture of Jesus atop their stand. And the Help, Mom, There Are Liberals Under My Bed book was really meant for conservative parents to sit down with their kids and teach their children their traditional conservative family values in a really fun and entertaining way.
Okay, Jeremy, how about your book, which is titled Why Mommy is a Democrat?
Well, my book really looks like sort of an ordinary children's picture book. It has a sort of happy, fluffy family of squirrels living in a park. And in each scene, there is some text, such as Democrats make sure everyone plays by the rules just like mommy does. And the happy squirrel family are sort of living out this value of the Democratic Party. In the background, there is sort of a darker reality, if you will. And for the adult reader, they will pick up on the fact that these humans are living in this Republican reality where things are not quite so rosy as in the Democratic land of the squirrels.
Okay, now I'm looking at some sample pages from your book. And one of the panels shows, you know, the mommy squirrel and her two kid squirrels playing happily. And then in the background, we see this image of a homeless man on a bench and some fat cat with a big tax rebate check under his arm, walking with his well-coiffed Republican wife right past the homeless man. He's not sharing, just like mommy does. You think kids aren't going to notice that image?
I think kids will see the image, but to a child 4, 5, 6 years old, I don't think they're going to recognize that this is a Republican couple walking by a homeless man. I think they're going to see three people in a park and nothing more.
How about this? You're reading the book to your child. Daddy, who is that man with the cigar? What do you tell him?
Well, I would probably try to explain that those are people who have a lot of money and they seem not to be helping the person who doesn't have a lot of money. But I was very careful in this book to make sure that none of the illustrations or the text explicitly talk about Republicans or George Bush or anything related to the Republican Party so that parents are really free to interpret.
Daddy, that man isn't sharing. Is he a Democrat?
That, again, I would.
Daddy, if he's not a Democrat, what is he? What's a not Democrat called?
If parents want to discuss that as being a Republican and talk about the values of the Republican Party and make the comparison or the contrast with the Democratic Party, that's the parents' prerogative. Parents are going to do that with or without this book.
Catherine, you're a Republican. How do you feel about your fellow travelers being portrayed as fat cats who ignore desperate homeless people in city parks?
Well, the Republicans have been portrayed as that for years. I don't mention Republican or Democrat. I really talk about traditional conservative family values that are undermined by the liberal ideology in this country.
Now, do you think children are in a position to understand what it means to have good, wholesome family values undermined by the liberal majority? Do you think they can get their arms around that concept?
I think in some ways they can. I, as a parent of three kids, have constantly seen, whether it's on the television or the books that are in the schools and one that my child brought home, that businesses are all greedy and out there to take everybody's money and make everybody poor and work long hours. So the Liberals Under My Bed book really is more of a balance to say, look, overtaxation, overregulation, and being offended by anything Christian does undermine these children's pursuit of the American dream.
Let me tell you both a story. It involves my daughter, Allison, who once upon a time was in third grade. And in third grade, she was asked to write a list of her pet peeves, people she actually doesn't like. And the first one was murderers. After that was lumberjacks. And I said, lumberjacks? Murderers, lumberjacks? Allie, why lumberjacks? And she said, well, they cut down trees.
Right.
Now, that kind of made me mad because it told me that in school she was learning ecology and the value of protecting the environment. But it was a tough lesson to teach little kids because little kids, where there is good, they're seeking evil. Can your books exist without creating an evil other?
You know, kids are, I think, a little smarter than you're giving them credit for. And I'm not sure how old your daughter is, but I imagine if she hasn't yet, at some point she's going to learn that lumberjacks aren't evil.
When she was 14, she killed a lumberjack just to watch him die.
Okay. Well, I stand corrected. And
okay, I made that up. But do we want to traumatize children by showing them that there are some bad people out there, half of America, in fact, who does not have their best interests at heart?
My children basically helped me write my book in a lot of ways. And my son's best friend's parents are liberals. He's not running around saying, oh, you're a liberal. You know, they appreciate the point of debate and learning other views, but they also know why we believe this ideology is really best for us.
Go back in time with me for a moment, Catherine, to before you got the idea for this book.
Sure.
Okay, please complete this sentence.
Mm-hmm.
Help, Mommy, there are blank under my bed.
Okay, I can see where you're going with this. Let me tell you the story of how I got the title for Help, Mom, There Are Liberals Under My Bed. I was watching the RNC convention back in 2000. My son came upstairs, sat on my bed, and I was explaining to him that we were electing a new president and that I wanted Bush to win and not the liberal Gore. And he asked why, and I said, well, because the harder daddy works and the more money he makes, the more liberals want to take that money out of his pocket. So he's sitting on my bed, his eyes get real big and wide, and he looks under the bed and says, well, where are these liberals, Mom? That was the perfect title for my book.
Catherine DeBrecht is a freelance newspaper reporter and author of Help, Mom, There Are Liberals Under My Bed. Jeremy Zilber teaches political science at Lawrence University in Wisconsin. His book is called Why Mommy is a Democrat. It seems like Catherine DeBrecht, in her last answer, made precisely the point I was arguing. Her son was looking for liberals under the bed, which is where kids typically expect monsters to be. Renowned developmental psychologist Jean Piaget believed that children under the age of 11 were incapable of the kind of abstract thinking that, say, politics requires. Modern theorists have since revised that number down, but many still subscribe to Piaget's broader stages of child development. Dr. Andrew Getzfeld teaches psychology at New Jersey City University and at NYU. He says that it's a stretch to expect very young readers to approach these books critically.
If you're looking at the conservative book, which according to Amazon is targeted at a reading level for kids from 4 to 8, children that are 4, depending on which theorist you believe in general, really don't have the capacity to make decisions other than dichotomous decisions. In other words, they see everything as black and white. They're not going to be able to distinguish between fine shades of meaning. For example, if you tell them conservatives do this, this, and this, what they will say is that, okay, conservatives are either good or they're bad, and the same thing with Democrats. In other words, there's no in-between for them because they can't really think in abstractions.
What do books like these teach children?
And that's a good question. That's something I was thinking about last night and then coming down here on the subway. I think what they teach kids is to look at things only through one perspective. To me, both books are examples of propaganda, which is fine. That's really what politics is all about for the most part. But it doesn't allow kids to think independently, to form their own decisions, and it teaches them to compartmentalize either people or political groups or what have you, to look at, for example, all Democrats, all liberals as being bad, taking things away from us, or as all Republicans as being bad, also taking things away from us.
Not to put too fine a point on it, is it good parenting to expose your kids to, you know, very simplistic stereotypes and call it instilling values?
What we really don't want, or at least what parents should not want from my perspective, is to create really mini versions of themselves. Well, a lot of parents do that. My belief is that within reason, kids should be allowed to make their own choices. And that's what Piaget said, is that a child learns best by being an active explorer in his or her environment. Now, to me, the way I interpret that is that children should try everything on their own within reason, even if they get hurt, not seriously, obviously, but even if they get hurt, they should be able to learn from that. Instead, if we end up sheltering kids, and that's really a form of sheltering by saying, okay, this group is like this, everybody else is bad. In effect, you're forcing kids really to make a decision before they're able to understand really what the differences are.
Okay. Well, Andy, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it. Thank you for having me.
Dr. Andrew Getzfeld teaches in the psychology department at New Jersey City University and New York University and is a member of the American Psychological Association.
This week, the 2006 Pulitzer Prize winners were announced. Almost immediately, some slammed the awards for perceived anti-Bush bias. Two awards received most of the attention. The first for a Washington Post investigation into secret CIA prisons in Europe, and the second for a New York Times piece that exposed the National Security Agency's domestic spying program. William Bennett, former Reagan and Bush senior administration official, said on his radio show that the reporters were, quote, not worthy of an award, they're worthy of jail. Overlooked in this controversy, the prize for criticism awarded to Washington Post fashion writer Robin Given. It was a first for that Pulitzer Award. Surprising, but not so surprising once you read the trenchant political commentary contained in Given's sparkling prose. Here's what she wrote about Vice President Dick Cheney's outerwear when world leaders gathered in Poland last year to mark the 60th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz. Quote, dressed in the kind of attire one typically wears to operate a snowblower, Cheney stood out in a sea of black-coated world leaders because he was wearing an olive drab parka with a fur-trimmed hood. It is embroidered with his name. It reminded one of the way in which children's clothes are inscribed with their names before they're sent away to camp. And indeed, the vice president looked like an awkward boy amid the well-dressed adults. But Given says the first piece to cause real buzz was the one she wrote about Katherine Harris, who as Florida's Secretary of State presided over the contested 2000 presidential election vote count in Florida.
She was quite a lightning rod, and she also had a really unusual appearance when she got in front of the camera. She was wearing an incredible amount of makeup. It was thick and it looked like a mask, and it seemed to suggest that at a time when what the country seemed to really need was a calm and a very methodical, thoughtful approach to the recount, here was a woman who seemed intent on drawing an incredible amount of attention to herself.
You were saying that her makeup job, the sheer artificiality of it, just made you nervous.
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of the way that we perceive a message has to do with the messenger.
Did you get an angry response from that piece? Did people say, look, get your nose out of politics and keep it in fashion where it belongs?
I would say that I got a flash flood of outrage. You know, it really surprised me in part because they all seemed to believe that I had a real agenda in mind, whereas I didn't. I was simply looking at, you know, this person delivering the information.
For instance, you wrote very favorably about the wardrobe choices of Condoleezza Rice during a visit to a German military base last year when she wore knee-high boots and a black coat. You compared her to something from the film The Matrix, and you wrote, she walked out draped in a banner of authority, power, and toughness. She was not hiding behind matronliness, androgyny, or the stereotype of the steel magnolia. Rice brought her full self to the world stage, and that included her sexuality. It was not overt or inappropriate. If it was distracting, it's only because it is so rare.
Well, I think one of the reasons why I was so enthusiastic about Condoleezza Rice's appearance was because she showed this real interest and appreciation for fashion and for style. And what I loved about it was that it was sexy. It was really, for me, like a breath of fresh air. You know, I'm not looking to see if they're wearing designer labels necessarily, unless for some reason it really stands out, as when Martha Stewart, for instance, went to court arguing that she was this sort of every woman who was being unfairly attacked, and she walked in with an Hermes Birkin bag, which is, you know, easily a $10,000 handbag.
Is there a fashion stereotype for the American politician, male and female?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the uniform for the male politician is the dark suit, the white shirt, and always a red tie. And lately, it's been an American flag pin on the lapel. For women, it typically is a suit in either red or blue or perhaps black. And their lapel accessory is the eagle perched atop a pearl.
Oh, dear.
Yes. It is the famed eagle on the pearl pin.
So I wonder how politicians in general react to you, whether you make them quake in fear. Because after all, you criticize them in an area they're not as well versed in as, say, they might be in healthcare or immigration reform.
Well, I think a lot of them are well-versed enough in that they know that when they get up there in front of the public, people are taking in the whole image from the business suit to the words that are coming out of their mouth. And I think one of the reasons why male politicians tend to wear a uniform is because it is an easy way to kind of quickly dispense with the physical and get straight to the words.
So who's Washington's worst fashion victim? Who's the fashion plague? Come on.
You know, I try not to so much say good or bad, but more what's going on there? Just why?
Is it sometimes utterly inexplicable?
The short answer is yes. Sometimes you look at what some of these guys are wearing and some of the women are wearing, and you just think, no full-length mirror. Like, what were you thinking?
Robin, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Robin Given is a fashion writer at the Washington Post and recipient of the 2006 Pulitzer Prize for Criticism.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Volo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson our engineer. We had help from Mark Phillips, Ani Katz, and Andy Lancet. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support from the media comes from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Thanks for checking out this week's On the Media from WNYC, New York Public Radio. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.